Hi, my name is Michael Poli, and I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. My friends are obsessed and always make jokes and references to it. And so now, 20 years later, I've been convinced to watch the show from beginning to end, one episode a week. I'm a Buffy virgin. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Buffy Virgin. We are now approaching the end of season one with episode 11, Out of Mind, Out of Sight. This one premiered May 19th, 1997. This is almost through season one, which is awesome. So I'm joined today by John, a school teacher.
Hello.
And Buffy enthusiast. And Travis, a doctor and also a Buffy enthusiast.
Hi, good afternoon.
Are you still going by Travis Frog?
the name Frog has been severely damaged in the past couple of weeks, so Travis works.
Travis works, okay. Did something happen in your family that you can't use the Frog name anymore?
Oh my gosh, not my family, but the media.
All right, well, I'm sorry to hear about that. There's been so many explosions in the media relating to frogs and the Frog name. It's been tarnished.
Greatly tarnished.
So this is the Buffy Virgin podcast. I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I'm watching it all the first time with my best friends here. We are going to talk through the episode in acts. So every Buffy Vampire Slayer episode has the same structure. It starts with an opening that kind of sets up the drama in the episode. Then act one, act two, and act three follows suit. We could do five acts, but we're going to do three acts. That seems to work. So I'll talk through each part. I can be interrupted at any time by my guests who will let me know their thoughts, whether random or related to the episode. They will do their best to stay on continuity and not discuss things that have happened after this episode, but focus on this episode and the episodes before it. So this is, again, season one, episode 11. It aired May 19th. It's directed by Riza Badai, B-A-D-A-I-Y-I. And it's... story by Joss Whedon. I don't see a writing credit here. It says teleplay by Ashley Gable and Thomas Swiden. Any of these names mean anything to you? Shaking your head.
Yeah, not too much. Reza Badia was a director that did direct, I think, a lot of episodes. I think he was, he was quite in advanced in his career. I think he was in his 60s when this happened. That's what's interesting about him. He directed, different stuff. Hawaii Five-O, Doris Day show, even some Star Trek Deep Space Nine episodes, apparently.
Oh, this is some good trivia for our future, roles as Buffy the Vampire trivia, hosts. So this episode, Out of Mind, Out of Sight, it opens with... where the school is preparing for the May Queen, which is a big deal. It's a big homecoming style or, prom style event. It's unclear to me what the May Queen is. I think it's more of a prom style event is how it looks, at least by the end of the episode. But it opens, it looks like we're walking with Cordelia. So she appears to be the main focus of this episode. She's walking with her new beau, Mitch, who calls out her beautiful eyes. And she says, "My eyes are hazel, Helen Keller." Super, super weird and mean to this guy that's apparently her boyfriend. So as they're walking down the hall, Mitch and Cordelia run into Buffy, who drops all of her Slayer toys and weapons. She claims they belong to Giles. She's just borrowing them. And she just looks like a goof to Cordelia, who makes fun of her. From there, we kind of cut into a classroom where Miss Miller is going over The Merchant of Venice and asking people to give their opinions of the Shylock character. And Cordelia completely misses the point of the character and instead says, why is this guy so self-obsessed? What's his deal? And then tells a story that shows her own blindness and self-obsession when she almost hits someone with her car, who's on a bike, and says, "Why didn't this person feel sorry for me? I've been going through a lot. I almost killed somebody."
Do we think that's a shout out to the earlier episode where she actually goes blind? Right. That's probably the driver's ed thing, right?
That actually happens, right?
Oh yeah.
Is that, I'm trying to remember. Did she actually
hit a pedestrian?
No, no, she, She almost hits like a UPS truck or something.
A UPS truck, but yeah, like,
it's totally non-paranormal. It's a non-paranormal episode where she almost kills somebody. That's great.
So that was episode 3, The Witch, which I just finished editing. So I just listened to your guys' this whole conversation about that.
Yeah.
And I just think it's funny that it implies that she got the license, because the driver's ed teacher is extremely frustrated with her because this is like her last chance to pass her ed, and she goes blind. So then apparently she got her license after that, and then, you know, at least was driving and hit somebody.
And hit someone and almost killed them.
Pretty recently, I guess, because that's only a few episodes since.
Yeah.
There's also a reference to the time that Buffy almost attacked Cordelia at the Bronze, or, you know, thought that she was a vampire or something. Cordelia references that in the opening scene.
And also the opening scene has like pseudo narration, where you hear Cordelia talking, but you don't see her. And then eventually she walks into the frame, which is like a very old school TV where you can hear like TV, like a trick where like you hear people talking as they drive away in a car, like they're at us. There's no way you could legitimately hear them with the camera. So I don't know. It's old school, like interesting TV, like opening.
Yeah, that happens a couple of times in that episode. Yeah. That's a good call. That pseudo voiceover. So Cordelia is completely full of herself, but still is very interested in getting Miss Miller's opinion. It's very unusual that she has this attachment to Miss Miller and then her teacher, and wants to talk to her about her Merchant of Venice paper ideas. But she's so flustered because she has so much going on right now. From there, we cut into the boys' locker room where Mitch brags to the guys about how it's not Cordelia's arm he's looking to be on top of or whatever, get with. I mean, it's some really raunchy line about getting with Cordelia. And then he's attacked by an invisible baseball bat. By a POV camera attacked by a baseball bat that is somehow propelled magically in the air. That's kind of the opening here set up. I did miss one thing. There's a new character here, Harmony, who's Cordelia's friend. She appears really briefly. And happens my cat is named Harmony.
She appears Harmony that she has a ton of speaking lines.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of new characters?
Well, no. I mean, she has a ton of lines. Harmony has been in episodes before. She was the, if you remember, in the computer lab, I think that's the first sighting of Harmony. She and Cordelia are talking smack in the computer lab.
Oh, well, then this feels like her biggest standout role then. I didn't really
know. Much so.
Very I don't much. Think she has a name before now, though.
No.
Is that right?
I don't recall her having a name.
I don't remember. Actually, I tried to listen. Yeah. I think this might be, well, I'm not sure. Anyway, that's not important. But
I do kind of want to interrupt with this brief Buffy the Vampire Slayer story, because I was watching this episode on an airplane to Orlando to meet up with Dennis, who's not on the podcast. And as I was watching this episode, a woman next to me who looked like Eliza Dushku grabbed me and was like, oh my God, you're watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer? And this woman I had nothing in common with. I'm just sitting next to her on the plane. I literally said nothing to her. She was suddenly very interested in me, wanted to know everything about me and why I'm watching Buffy and who my favorite characters are and what my favorite seasons were. And then she found out about the podcast, told about that. She was so excited. It was kind of like, if I was a single man, it would have been really exciting. Does she want to be on the podcast? You know what? I didn't ask her about being on the podcast. That wasn't where I was thinking about.
This is deeply unfair, I think, you know, for those of us who have been watching this show for decades and have been waiting for some, woman who looks like Eliza Dushku to sit down next to us and say, oh, you're interested in Buffy? I'm interested in Buffy. Waiting for that to happen for 20 years. You've been watching Buffy for 3 months and all of a sudden this happens. That's deeply unfair.
The reason it's unfair for it is twofold. Number one, he didn't even understand the irony of talking to someone who looked like Elijah Dushku about Buffy. That was A. That alone should have just taken that plane out of the sky.
Wait, does irony crash planes now? Is that?
Well, I mean, you know.
Be very careful on planes.
Yeah, you do. And there's another reason I was upset. Oh, then I was just going to say, this is classic Michael/Xander Harris luck. So, and this is the episode where Xander Harris looks the most like Michael, or Michael looks the most like Xander. It's this episode. The hair is like perfect Xander Harris Michael.
Refer to the Buffy version website where we will post a picture of Michael looking like Xander.
Oh, yeah.
Please.
Anyways, I think, you know, I'm just tackling this. This is the most giggly episode of Buffy that I think I've seen so far. So who's got the giggles? Well, Cordelia, for some reason, in the first couple scenes is ending every sentence with a half laugh. That was super weird, but kind of adorable. And then, of course, Willow and Xander have got like the incredible giggles when they're trying to tell Buffy this story. And I think it's the most adorable I've ever seen Willow up to this point in the series. And I think it's just pretty amazing so far. I mean, I don't know what's so giggly, but hands down, the most giggles so far in like the first 10 minutes, 8 minutes, whatever it is.
So, go ahead, John, sorry.
I was going to say, I wanted to talk about just briefly about Cordelia and in the class scene, because she refers to the Shylock speech as a Twinkie dispense. And so are you guys aware of the origin of this phrase, Twinkie defense? I had to look it up to make sure I had it right.
Please, I'm vaguely aware, but I'm sure I would have it wrong.
Yeah, so the guy who killed Harvey Milk, basically the first openly gay American politician who was, I think, city councilman in San Francisco. I'm probably getting the details wrong.
Yep, Sean Penn.
Yeah, played by Sean Penn in that movie. And there was a really good documentary before that about his life. But the man who assassinated him, famously, his defense in court was that he was depressed. And I guess the popular understanding of the defense that he was given by his lawyers was that he was depressed because he had recently changed his diet to include more junk food like Twinkies. I guess, according to Wikipedia, what the lawyers actually had said was that the sudden switch to Twinkies in his diet was not the cause of him being depressed and killing somebody so much as his switch in diet to Twinkies was indicative that there was something wrong and that he was depressed, and that was what was really going on. Obviously, either way, a pretty flimsy excuse for assassinating Harvey Milk. But I think that culturally, the phrase Twinkie defense just means like a...
it's bullshit. You know,
a flimsy bullshit defense. Right, exactly.
But that's a fun 90s cultural... I mean... 90s, I guess that's 80s.
80s, I think, is when it happened, but it's certainly more current then than it was now. I mean, I don't know that I've heard anybody use that phrase
in a long time. I don't know what illegal trial would you bring up now if you were to say like, oh, it's bullshit. Like someone's like, oh, you're using the whatever defense.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, the 90s is kind of the era of like the courtroom drama on television. So it's probably like, I mean, that's when all the Maury Povich, Jerry Springer BS was really its height before reality TV kind of became single camera and then went out of the studio. I mean, that's the early origin of reality TV. And then it's like, why don't we just go to these people's homes and see what their lives are really like?
Yeah.
But yeah, that courtroom drama stuff like in the 90s was pretty present.
I really love in this scene that Cordelia is finally a person. And that the way that they do it is that she asks for help on her paper. To me, that was like super endearing that she has a really weird read on Shakespeare that no one else has and that she wants help on her paper. Like that is, she's not so completely lost in her narcissism that she can't admit that she's having difficulty. She wants to do better. She wants to meet her teacher to do better. Like all of that.
It's just a convenient setup for her to get, you know, to witness another crime. But yeah.
Oh, I disagree. I think this is the writers finally giving her some dimension. I mean, it's undercut. They have to continue giving the jabs at her character and that she's still really shallow. All of those jabs are still there, but there's this other level now where she's an actual person. And it's continued later in the episode, but I thought that was a great way to do it, that she actually admits she has a problem. Her paper's not working out. She wants help. The teacher cares about her, and I don't know. It was I really like that scene.
I love the scene. Well, I guess Michael summarized, but just like love the idea that like Buffy is always getting to like the crime scenes first. Like when this guy's attacked by the bat, and you know, she's there always there to check the scene out, and then of course Will and Xander do this awesome distraction of Principal Snyder, and I know I'm going to have to listen to Michael and John's reaction when Principal Snyder first came on the scene, but I don't know. He's great. He's so slimy. So great.
So let's get into Act One. Before we haven't discovered the situation with Mitch at this point, but Cordelia's walking around with chocolates for people to consume because she wants everyone to associate her with sweetness. And so she's got chocolates with the sea she's handing out. Of course, she's also handing out insults to her friends, insulting, Harmony. She doesn't want to give any chocolates to Buffy. She doesn't need the lunatic fringe vote, which is a funny concept that there would be a lunatic fringe vote in a high school, basically popularity contest. There's this weird kind of back and forth with Willow and Xander because they share a private story that Buffy doesn't have access to. Just this old classic story about Cordelia when another time that she was chasing a title. And it's a funny setup because then Buffy gets to be kind of hurt by it because not only is she doesn't have access to the story, but also they make fun of the idea of anybody wanting to be a May Queen at all. And she was a May Queen at her previous school in Los Angeles. And hey, it wasn't that bad, whatever. It's not a big deal. Of course, it's a different school, whatever the excuse. But it's kind of a neat, like, very real feeling experience for the new girl. And, like, this feels like something we'd expect to see earlier in the season, but here it is, like, another reminder that you're different from everybody else. So then Mitch gets attacked. He's already been attacked, but we discover that he's not dead. Snyder's very concerned that students are dying on campus, but not this time. There's a hint. So Willow and Xander distract him by saying that, Mitch's parents, his dad is a lawyer known as the Beast, and he's going to sue the school. So Willow and Xander distract him while Buffy goes in the locker room to investigate the crime. She discovers this weird, eerie message. Look, written on a locker. Want to point out here that Willow is wearing a Scooby-Doo shirt, which is appropriate, and the first time they've referenced the fact that they're the Scooby Gang, as far as I can tell. You guys have been calling them the Scooby Gang for quite some time, and there's a Scooby-Doo shirt. Awesome. So very knowing. So then we're in the lunchroom where Giles appears. I don't know how many times he's appeared in the lunchroom. He's a library man only, but he shows up, and they've already figured out it's either telekinesis or an invisible person. Or a ghost.
So
we already have a sense of who could be responsible for this attack. Xander has a good joke in here about vampire bats.
It's a quality joke.
It's a really good joke.
So then Cordelia and Harmony are hanging out together. Cordelia is upset. She just went to visit Mitch in the hospital. But she's really only concerned. Everything is like very Whedon-y. She's like, oh, I'm so concerned. I hope he doesn't look bad in her, May King Queen photos. It's like, yeah, she doesn't really care. It's a very superficial character. But then we cut to this really weird POV of another student, watching Cordelia and Harmony have a different conversation about Mitch at a different time even. The timeline's a little weird here, but we cut back from that POV back to the scene. And then Harmony gets kind of pushed or falls down the stairs. The principal shows up right away, suspiciously quickly. The principal shows up to deal with, the situation, figure out what's going on with Harmony. Buffy wants to investigate, and she goes into the band room to take a look around. And that's where she sees something disappear into the ceiling. And that's where I think at the end of Act 1 is, because it's like we've kind of introduced that there is something. Buffy actually bumps into an invisible person, so we know, gone from speculation to identifying that it's an invisible something.
Can I say two things quickly?
Of course.
with that alternate sort of flashback, I'm wondering, is that the first flashback we have in Buffy to scenes that weren't originally shown? We've had flashbacks to events that have happened in episodes. Within an episode, I think we've had a couple flashbacks to intra-episode. This is like, is this the first time we see like a true flashback to off? Oh my God.
Oh my gosh, we're suddenly joined by mysterious cartoonist, Dennis St. John. Welcome.
Hi, Dennis. Hey, I just wanted to pop in and say hi to you guys because I miss you.
Oh man, we miss you too.
We miss you.
So what's up? How's the show going? Let me put on some headphones.
Hold on. Yeah. This show has truly surprise guests.
Oh, the ceiling of that ballroom is gorgeous.
Dennis, climb up into the ceiling and see if there's a ghost in there. It's got a drop ceiling.
All right, I'm back. I got my headphones in. I just missed you guys. Wanted to say hi.
Hi. Any thoughts about season one, episode 11? We're just into act one right now.
Okay. I don't know if you guys look. Claire Duvall did an interview on the AV Club where she talked about this episode and had really positive things to say. Somebody should pull that up and quote from that. Yeah, good episode. I'm sorry I couldn't be there for it. Sorry we couldn't get Steve there, but we'll do another Steve episode. Figure it out.
How's Alien Con?
It's really weird. It's interesting. I'm having fun. It's way more serious than I thought it would be. I was thinking it's called Alien Con, but it's on Halloween weekend. It'll be like a horror show. But, like, people are totes serious about aliens here. Like, everything is totally packed for the ancient alien people. And, like, I mean, people have theories that I am hearing. I got a book called Myth, The Origin of Man, about the reptilian origins of men. I got some interesting stuff I'll share with you guys later.
Yes, please. Let's do a super podcast where you tell us about what happened at AlienCon.
Yeah.
Wow. What are some of the theories you heard about?
I don't know all of them. I know one. Here, let me pull up. I got a flyer I'll read from.
Oh, only important information is passed on flyers.
Also, like, you know, no offense to the guy, but to have a whole booth and this is what you're selling is like a flyer. could a human species
have Subway coupons on it on the back? Look on the back. It may have coupons for food.
It's like
wasted opportunity.
But it's about the idea that I think humans are cloned and that Earth, all aliens are clones, and that's why statues look the same across. I don't know. I don't quite get it yet, but there's something there. But he was trying to contact the ancient alien people and get on, like, they need to know, but they're blocking me.
Well, there's only so many recipes for humankind. It would make sense, that, you know, they're all clones.
That's true, yeah. There's only so much D you can N-A, I don't know.
Man, that sounds like so much fun. I would love to go to one of those things as an attendee.
Yeah, I wish I could have gone to some of these panels, but sitting here has been the whole thing.
Are you the only comics person there?
What?
Are you the only comics person there?
No, there's a few others. Famous Monsters is here, and they have their comics anthologies. And yeah, there's a few other, like, I'm in Artist Alley. It's mostly artists. People doing, like, Godzilla prints and stuff. I met one of the original Godzilla men. I posted that today on Instagram and stuff.
That was cool.
And he really liked my issue of Doublethink, probably because it's a silent comic, so he could look at it and understand it. But I told his translator, I was like, I stole that texturing from Godzilla, and he was like, yes. All right, I'll see you guys later. Love you.
All right, I love you too, man.
Bye, Dennis.
Bye.
If only Dennis could see me.
How do I stop this thing?
What a fun episode of this podcast already. It was a surprise guest.
Gosh, that was sudden.
All right. I'm going back to my 2 points because I'm keeping us on track.
Good job, Travis.
Okay, so I think, I don't know, I want you guys to rack your brains, and I'll try to do some research into this later. I'll be research guy. But, you know, I don't know, I think this might be the first episode where we flashed back to events never before previously seen in an episode. But it's interesting. So that one part was interesting, and that's the flashback with Cordelia in the bathroom and that girl, Marcy Ross. And then number two, kind of a subtle thing, I really think that Cordelia's hair is especially curly in this episode. I know that that's a minor detail. She has normally curly hair, but stylized a bit different. So it looks actually kind of like weirdly fantasy curls. It's a bit interesting, especially when she's wearing the May Queen outfit later on. But those were the two things that really kind of, in that little short period of time, that sort of came up. Anyways.
No, thanks for noticing some of this hairstyle stuff. It's kind of an interesting, because, like, that sort of shows how they don't really know what the character looks like, right? Like, they're kind of figuring it out.
Yeah, certainly. Well, and you know, not to violate the timeline, but her hairstyle is in a couple different episodes somewhere along the way. And so they may comment about it later on, which is funny, but not for a long time. But anyways, after seeing, you know, I don't know, probably like 40 hours of Cordelia on screen, you can pick up these differences. Anyways, that's kind of sad.
I noticed some weird things also this episode. Buffy's got some really weird rings on this episode.
She does. It's seen at the very end of the episode. And the other interesting thing is actually the color blue is very dominant in this episode. You see Cordelia wearing basically light sky blue, Harmony wearing a sky blue outfit, and then Buffy wears a sky blue top at the very end of the episode. So blue, I don't know, for some reason was on the set designer's minds. And it's taking place in spring, but I don't know, not necessarily a springtime color, but anyway, so this light blue is just everywhere in this episode. Although, interestingly enough, the Invisible Girl is wrapped up in a red curtain. I'm not sure there's any much meaning in that, but it's certainly interesting to think about.
That is interesting. I don't know all the color significance and if it's done with great intention or not. I'm sure there is some intention for sure, but I wonder how much that's intentional. I mean, red is blood, right? Like, you know, she's kind of finished at that point. It's also red as flesh. I don't know. Let's talk about that again when we get there.
John, I don't know. Maybe, John, do you know? I mean, when the people who dress the actors, they're not necessarily the same department as the people who are dressing the set, or are they?
I don't really know. I would assume that costumes and set are more or less separate, but I don't know.
Okay, because it could have happened by accident, or they could have colluded, planned it.
I have no idea.
Okay, all right, never mind. There's my minutia for this a little bit. Also, of course, you know, this is the classic episode where Buffy's forced, you know, since becoming the Slayer, she's forced to be the outsider. So she herself is like a ghost. You know, she had all these great things she used to do, but now she's not a normal girl. So she's not invisible, but she's not what she once was. So I don't know. So I think that of course comes up in this episode clearly.
Mm-hmm. They definitely want you to relate to like the idea of what an outcast is.
Yeah.
We'll definitely talk about it in the themes of this episode.
Also, Giles spends a ton of time. Giles spends a ton of time at school and he has never noticed this ghost. He's not especially observant man or librarian or watcher. But man, he totally he's never seen this friggin' ghost. Well, or heard it. Or heard flute playing. I don't know. It's just funny. Rant. So, I'm done ranting.
Well, we'll bring out some more rants in a bit. So Act 2, we have the introduction of the Men in Black. So there's just these weird kind of FBI agent characters on the periphery, you know, wearing suits and stuff, kind of watching. So they're kind of putting it together, the Scooby gang, about what happened. So a girl actually bumped into Buffy, an invisible girl. So it's not a ghost. We're talking about if a ghost goes through you, you would know. Nope, this bumped into me. It's definitely an invisible girl. So Buffy kind of figures it out. We also learned, strangely, Xander's parents don't cook, apparently. They just order takeout. This is a weird little moment from Willow and Xander. Once again, alienating Buffy somewhat from this special relationship that she can't, you know, get into. So Buffy decides to start the hunt. Giles says, you may have to work on listening. And this is a special little lesson here because I think pays off pretty well at the end. I was really impressed with the payoff of this one. So then Buffy's in the school late at night, and for some reason, I don't know why, Cordelia is getting dressed at the school or trying on a dress. Anybody want to take a guess at why that is? Why it's at the school?
It is like this insane sort of Cordelia. It's this great queen and handmaiden scene. Cordelia, for some reason, is dressed in this very sort of like medieval fantasy style dress, which looks great. And she has, you know, four or five handmaidens, and it's a court of Cordelia. Those are the cordettes, you know. This will make sense later, but those are phrases that you'll hear later, but in this series. But I don't understand it at all. But it's a super cool, like, kind of like a it finally in this episode is kind of like this really fun, like, happy scene. Like there is like a normal life that is in Sunnydale, and it's this, and sure, it's Cordelia and she's kind of evil but not evil, but I don't know, it's just like this fun moment. I'll rant about this later, but it's just like a really cool, like, just real moment. I don't know,
if this was like a film, if this episode was like a feature film, I think they could play out this scene a little bit longer.
Oh, much longer.
Stranger, and play some cool music, like whatever the alt music of now. Like, it would be kind of a rad scene. But it is.
I was surprised it was so short. I was surprised it was very short, that scene. There probably maybe it was a longer scene they shot and they just couldn't make the cut for the episode.
Well, yeah, because it makes no sense. That's why they had to cut it. Like, Buffy looks through a window, sees Cordelia trying to dress. She'd be doing that at home. She shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. I bet certainly this was a longer scene that had dialogue that was cut.
So then we cut to Giles. He hears a strange song. It's a flute. It sounds like it could just be music within the episode, so it takes a second to notice that that's what's going on, because, like, sometimes there is strange music, but... Then Angel appears suddenly, and it's quite a shock. Like, I don't expect to see Angel ever. And then Giles looks, he doesn't see his reflection. And then Angel is there suddenly. Angel has no advice or information that will help Giles figure out the Invisible Girl. And even comments like, huh, that's not really my, I don't really know about that stuff. But he does have apparently a lead on the Codex, which is some secret book of information about the Slayer. So Angel says,
this is a step up in usefulness for Angel, actually. I don't think we should fault him for, like, not knowing about the Invisible Girl. We should applaud him that he finally has found something to do in the plot. Like, I'm not here for this episode, but in the next one, there's a book. Like, it's basically saying.
Yeah, he finally does stuff in this episode. Yeah. And it's not the first. I don't know. We have to remember. Is it the first, like, Angel has no reflection gag joke?
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, it's the first meaning of Giles and Angel as well. So it's got a lot of firsts.
Yeah, well, it's played out as both a gag, and it has, like, this really, like, cool, weird line that I think you could build more out of.
Oh, totally.
Angel says, like, Giles says, oh, it must be nice to be invisible, you know, in some way. Like, a vampire has the ability to be invisible and not see themselves in mirrors. And Angel has this fun line. It's like, it's an overrated pleasure. Like, you know, living an infinite lifetime, whatever. And I made me really empathize with Angel for a second, who's not a character I normally care about. And it ended the scene in a fun, interesting way. But man, Angel's random appearance. Great. I'm going to go grab a codex. I'll see you next episode for the finale.
I had to look up the word maudlin in the dictionary to understand what that was. Although I'm still not sure it's the best word choice for him.
But. It totally is. It totally is. It fits with Giles' character to call something maudlin.
No, it does. It fits with his character. Yeah.
For viewers or listeners, the maudlin not comment, I'm sure you've watched the episode, is referring to what Giles says as he's judging Buffy and Angel's relationship. Oh, a vampire loves a Slayer. That was a little dramatic and maudlin, you know?
Yeah.
Totally it's right
epic.
On.
It's epic, Giles. It's freaking epic.
It's not maudlin. Yeah, it's totally maudlin. It's like...
It's monumentous. It's
melodrama.
Yeah, it's and so modern. That was what I was like. Dramatic. That was what I was trying to tease out by looking at the...
Or hyper-dramatic. It's not...
Is there a degree to which Giles is kind of calling it out as being over the top or... Like
he's trying to call it out.
Yeah.
This show is full of over the top stuff.
John, can't you run this British English by your girlfriend and see if she thinks that's a normal, maybe it's a normal thing to say, but I feel like it's not.
Yeah, she just goes around calling everything maudlin. Like,
well, I don't know. Maybe she's like, that's what my dad said about my first boyfriend. You know? Listen, run the line by her, get back to us next week. And say, right. Oh, yeah, she says it's legit. She hears it all the time in the pubs when she was growing up.
Yeah, her favorite thing ever is representing all British people. That's her favorite thing.
Well, she can represent, like, a portion. Listen, let's break it down. Here's the deal. What can she represent? She can represent at least, like, 10 million people. All right, she's not going to represent Wales or Scotland or Northern Ireland, but she could represent, like, a circle, like a circular space in England. and I'll do some research of my own, and if, you know, Anthony Stewart Head was born within 500 miles of where she was born, I think it's legit.
A circular space in England, is that, like, are you referring to Stonehenge?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, 500 diameter, like, portion of land. call it what it is, a great crop circle of English behavior and mannerism and language.
So you're talking about, like, she can be a character witness for England.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm saying a 500-mile radius. I'm not saying all of England.
I mean, she's a fan. She does watch Buffy.
I'm saying, like, you know, she can represent, like, how I can represent.
This is a crazy tangent.
Ohio, Indiana, Pennsylvania, right? No, it's not like, it's like, that's too far out of the realm. Anyways.
I agree, Travis. I'm constantly having to represent, not constantly, but occasionally representing the Midwestern point of view. People are asking, oh, you're from Ohio. You probably know XYZ. Hey, so for instance, even this morning, someone was saying, went to this, you know, they're talking about white supremacists, and they're like, oh, you know, you're from Ohio. That's got to have, like, some white supremacists, right? I'm like, well, not really. I'm like, a little bit, though.
It was Indiana that had all the white supremacists.
Yeah, true.
But anyways, I want to say, I kind of love this super crazy room that Marcy Ross lives in. Like,
oh yeah, I wouldn't have that room.
Oh, it's like this extra room, and it's like not finished, but feels great. And
whoa, feels great. Wait.
It feels very homey. She's got this candelabra in there. I mean, it's like, it's super insane and just absolutely lovely at the same time.
Okay, Marcy's room is really insane. Let's get there. We're almost there. So
comforting.
So after the Angel and Giles kind of connection, then we cut to a POV shot once again where they're Cordelia, Harmony, and Marcy are joking about some teacher or something. There's a toupee joke that Marcy tries to make. Nobody hears her. And then Cordelia makes the exact same joke as if she, you know, overheard it enough that she would, you know, repeat it. But like, oh, I have a new observation. It's just like, it's a really shitty, you know, kind of moment where you totally see Marcy's point of view. And then we are cut to this really strange moment where Cordelia is giving a speech in the courtyard of school. Apparently about how pleased she is to be the next, you know, May Queen of some kind. From there, we kind of cut further away from the speech to where, you know, the Scooby gang is kind of talking about the disappearances. So Willow was in charge of finding a list of women that have disappeared. And Marcy is already, you know, number one most suspicious person. We're talking about, Marcy's a girl that disappeared. From there, Buffy does a band room investigation. She finds the room that we were talking about, this room, right? Where it's got like a stuffed bear. It's like a little girl's room. I mean, she's 16 years old.
A lot of books too. And you know.
Books, sleeping bag on the floor.
It was like where that lady lived, you know? She was 16. She didn't have a lot of stuff. So that's why she brought the teddy bear.
Box of cereal. I mean, it's just a sad little room.
I think it's awesome. Like, it's above everything else. It's crazy. It's got pretty good ceilings. Admittedly, it's got no paint on the walls, and for some reason it's all patched up. Like, it could be a real room. That's what doesn't make any sense. But I'm gonna give that a pass for right now. I think it's fantastic. It's a fantastic little place to be.
I think it's a super creepy room. It's well done in that, like, it's believably like a shitty place where this girl lives in the school somehow. Don't know her family situation or home life. Don't need to go into it. She's just believed missing or gone or whatever. And she's gone invisible. And so this is where her life is now. It's pretty sad. I do like, even though she's supposed to be 16, I do like the adolescent touches here. Like, she's not mature. It's not like, she's not a sex freak. She's not a weirdo. I mean, she's weird. What's that?
She's not a boy. She's not a sex freak. She's not a boy.
Right, well, right, that's true.
And Buffy, everyone who's a boy in Buffy is so far as a sex freak, except Angel.
Right, she's a girl, and girls want revenge. That's what girls want. They want to look good, and they want to take revenge.
Some of them want to be popular, some of them want to just not be lonely, but...
So from there, in that scene, though, there's a knife that gets raised behind Buffy, like it's going to strike her, and it totally would work, because Buffy doesn't see anything that's going on. It could have been, you know... started a scuffle of some kind, but nope, she looks around, knife is gone. And Buffy grabs a yearbook and then takes off. So then we cut to Miss Miller's office where she's suffocated with plastic by the invisible girl, by Marcy. And we think she's killed until Cordelia shows up, finds her suffocating, rips off the bag, and then we see Listen, written on the chalkboard. And that is the end of Act 2 for me. We find out more information, and this girl continues to be dangerous. Hunt continues. Any thoughts about this act that we didn't already discuss?
Stupid question. Do you think that Buffy crawling on the drop ceiling is intended as a visual homage to the Breakfast Club?
At least an emotional one.
Not really.
Not really.
Not that it's in the drop ceiling in high school. It's the only connection.
Yeah, that's about the only connection. I guess I would say at least, you know, to the naysayers for Cordelia out there, you know, mark it on your tally. Cordelia saves the teacher. She saves a life. I think it's the first life Cordelia saves so far. So this is monumentous.
Right. This is a positive mark in her book. Maybe she'll get a good gift this year.
It's the start of something new. Also, I also wish I had a yearbook from high school near me so I could see if anyone had written "Have a nice summer" in my yearbook, because then I know I would be a truly sad fellow.
Oh yeah, do you want to talk about the yearbook thing?
Oh, that's the next scene. Yeah, the yearbook thing. Totally vote for it.
I was just going to ask you this very question: like, did the yearbook thing ring at all true to you? It didn't for me. I didn't.
The yearbook thing rang for me in a different way, which is like, I remember people writing strange things in my yearbook, which would be inside. The word of sports part was like people writing inside jokes that I didn't understand.
That you weren't a part of.
I remember someone writing in my book, paint the town red. And it's like, I don't know. Paint the town. You know, I mean, like, whatever. Or someone would put song lyrics and you're like, I don't know that song. Like, you know, we should probably have a yearbook moment here where we pull out our yearbooks for this episode.
I never got the yearbook.
We were on the yearbook staff.
We were not.
We were on the Dome. We were on the Dome staff. Different publication.
Yeah. You guys were in the newspaper. I was not. But the yearbook, I think you had to buy one your senior year as part of your, like, to get your diploma. So that's in my dad's house. It's been there ever since I graduated. I don't think I ever looked at it, really.
I think I have mine upstairs. Yeah, they force you to subsidize that stupid publication. That's true. But it has pictures of everybody you know in it.
Yeah, it has pictures of a lot of people I don't really know that well.
Look, the yearbook would be fine if it's just pictures of you and your friends instead of pictures of all these idiots.
Well, I'm sure they're nice people. I never really talked to them.
No, they're all nice people.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's
I imagine our listenership includes quite a few of our...
All right, I edit my comment. I'm removing that comment then. I'll have to edit this episode now.
I don't know. I think your book is fine. I like your book. I don't know.
You like your yearbook, as in you buy them every year?
No, I don't think. I think you only really got them once a year. I'm not sure. I guess they could have sold them every year, but I think
yeah, every year. Yeah.
It's a yearbook. It comes out once a year. Well,
what I mean to say is that I'm not convinced that the underclassmen would buy the senior yearbook. I just wasn't sure there was much draw there. So I think
people did. I remember people did. I didn't. It was one of the many things I felt very smug about and still do.
Yeah, you still do. I don't know. I have a medical school yearbook, and it was produced
something.
It was produced just for the graduating class, so it's a little bit different. But anyways,
so let's move on here. So there's this moment about the yearbook, though. I think it's a real moment, right? And like, they're talking about something real, which is everybody writing this kind of cliched phrase, "Have a nice summer," and it's meaningless. And they don't even remember writing it. Oh, and you were in classes with this girl, and you don't remember her. And then some, Willow's like, "Well, I wrote 'Have a great summer.' You know, I must have, you know, probably have a better relationship than you guys." Like,
Willow is so smart.
And then everyone else is like, "Well, we were in four classes together. You don't remember?" Like, "Well, I guess not." It's a fun moment, right? Because I think this is all true. Like, there's always people in our classes that we didn't know. I mean, there are truly, you know, as terrible as high school might have been, like, there's still people that are more anonymous and have a worse experience than you.
Yeah, totally. I totally like that about that scene, the relativity of it all, that, you know, Willow and Xander might not be the cool kids, but at least they have friends, they have each other, and there are people who don't have that, and that did work.
Yeah, totally works. And then, then that's when Giles kind of puts it together. It's like, oh, it's actually a quantum physics or a quantum mechanical problem. And everyone's like, and then he's like, no, it's like, because we're on a hellmouth, when someone feels this isolated, things can literally happen. And, you know, this is the crazy thing about Buffy, and I want to talk about this for a second. It's like, this could have just been a metaphor, but Buffy needs to spell out every freaking metaphor to make it so. And it's like, hey, metaphorically, this woman became visible. But metaphors can come true in Buffy. Like, it's not dispensed, you know, there is no metaphor. Forget it. And literally, this is what happened. And so Marcy is perceived as invisible, she becomes invisible. So then we see the scene when Marcy turned invisible in class. It's a POV scene. I mean, it's not a POV scene. It's like a flashback, right? And so we see Marcy, the teacher ignores her even. She's raising her hand, and then she's shocked, and it's like a Marty McFly type moment, like, whoa, my hand is gone. What's going on? She turns invisible. Then Cordelia shows up in the library, and it's a freaking hilarious scene of Cordelia simultaneously wanting help, but also has the need to insult everyone there. About how they're such nerds. And she's, I love this line. She talks to Buffy. She's like, hey, you got all these weapons. I was kind of hoping you were in a gang. Maybe you could help me.
I want to know what kind of gang she thinks Buffy's in, where she's dropping like battle axes in the hallway. Like, is she in a medieval gang? Is she in like Society for Creative Anachronisms? What is she in?
So from there, we cut to a POV of Marcy again. She's, you know, rambling insane stuff while in her, you know, headquarters, her little hideout, and she looks like she's going to grab a rope. And then we cut to Buffy is Buffy is in the library again, still talking with Cordelia, and there's POV kind of Marcy looking from behind bookshelf, whatever. And then, you know, we talk, you know, Cordelia and Buffy kind of talk a little bit, and Cordelia has this really kind of honest and wonderful moment. It's probably the best moment in this episode for Cordelia, which says, like, I can be surrounded by people and be completely alone. And we have this neat dichotomy here in this theme about isolation, where it's like, oh, you can be surrounded by people and still feel alone. But Cordelia, you know, she says, like, Buffy challenges her, like, so why be popular? Why work on that if you're going to just feel alone anyway? And Cordelia says, being alone with others is better than being alone by yourself. And that's kind of this, you know, it's a very high school, you know, kind of problem, but it's like, it's well stated. I was happy with, really happy with that scene.
So Mike, I have to ask you, were you happy with Cordelia's delivery of that line or her acting in that scene in particular compared to episode one?
Oh, Cordelia's great in this episode. This is a fantastic Cordelia episode. Her comic delivery in this is so funny because she's like, I've been having this problem in my own life, and where I enable people by addressing them in the same tone and manner that they address me. But Cordelia kind of, I can go into that a little bit. I don't mean to be so like weird, but it's just like when you address people in the same tone and manner they address you, you are enabling them. You are saying that that conversation is real and their problems are real. You're empathizing. And I sometimes empathize with people I shouldn't. And that means includes homeless people and also crazy people, weird people in my life. But when reality, you got to like, there are other versions of reality, and Cordelia has her own version of reality, and she's always maintaining that version of reality, and she doesn't, it rarely breaks. She's rarely addressing people the way that they're addressing her, right? She has her own kind of way that she communicates, and I liked seeing that tone kind of shift and break in this episode.
So I'm going to ask a follow-up question on that. So have you ever seen an actor or actress improve as much as Cordelia has from episode one to episode 11? Mike,
I can't think of.
I know it's pretty cool. It's pretty amazing. I mean, I think it is pretty amazing.
I'm sure if I watched any of these long form sci-fi shows, it would happen. Like, I just don't watch any long form shows like this.
Yeah. All right. Fine.
I don't know if it's so much the acting. I think it's the writing. I think they finally gave her some feelings to have.
Her delivery is great.
Delivery is good, but it's not.
She learned
how to act. Like
no, she learned way. She learned so much. I mean, imagine how terrible. Yeah. Imagine how bad David Boreanaz was in the first two episodes. It was just speaking a line. Now he can have a reasonable conversation with Giles, and it looks pretty normal. Part of that's acclimation, but part of it's like he actually learned how to say his lines. Same story with Cordelia. I mean, I think it's a great development. I'm glad you think that that she's actually pretty good in this episode.
It's fun. I was laughing out loud every time she was in a scene.
Awesome.
She's a fun character. And yeah. This scene is like the best scene. This scene with her in the library and like, hey, nerds, I don't really like you, but I need your help.
Yeah. She says, Marcy, she is way eviler than me. Which is a classic line. That's a classic Buffy type line.
Right. And then Buffy's like, well, she's got a point.
Yeah. Anyway, so.
So then there's, I'll keep moving here. So then there's strange
flute. Move along, yeah.
Strange flute music. Giles, Willow, and Xander all follow the flute music, which is now established because Marcy is hiding in the band room, so maybe she's playing flute by herself.
She's a flautist.
Yeah. And then there's this weird scene where Cordelia's going to change in the closet because she needs, it's very important that she gets to the Bronze in time for the May dance or whatever, for this May event. She's really upset with having to change in the closet. Not sure why, but you know, it's not dignified in some ways.
It's a mop closet.
What is that?
Well, it's a closet that holds mops, dirty mops.
Mop.
It's a mop closet. I don't know what to say to that. It is kind of descriptive. You saw it. It looked dirty in a fancy dress. I get that. I get that character.
All right.
Also, best line. One of the best lines. Can we have the heartfelt talk with a little less talk from you?
Yeah, that was great.
I'm totally going to remember that and use it sometime. It's a beautiful Buffy moment. And
but don't you know people like that though? That like.
No, I don't. And in fact, here's another insane observations. Buffy on the outside of that mop closet has. Some of the really, I only noticed this because someone talked to me about it, but she has really great eye rolling that she does. She has some really great expressive eye rolling when she's talking with Cordelia. And so go back and watch that if you missed that. The only reason I noted that, because someone at work noted that I have very good eye rolling ability.
And when do you eye roll at work? All day?
I don't know. It was just eye rolling with someone talking to me about something, some such. I thought this is a normal human muscle movement. But anyways, so Buffy has some great eye rolling. Great, great comment. Can be the heartfelt talk with Lola's talking to you. Anyways, all right, let's speed up. Let's speed along the summary.
It's like a tiny scene where she changes in the closet. And yeah, that line from Buffy about, a little less talk from you is freaking awesome. I like it because Buffy's really trying to relate to Cordelia at that point. She's like, about her isolation. And yes. Cordelia is like, yours is kind of different. I mean, whatever. The implication is like, you're a real nerd and a loser.
I wasn't listening. Anyways, so this is the part where like, I know you're Michael. You're against how you have to spell everything out in Buffy episodes. And to be fair, a lot of Buffy episodes have to be very concrete. And the whole quantum mechanics plus magic thing was the concreteness of why is this lady invisible. But then I still think they talk about other stuff. This is the moments that I look at when I try to see what are they really trying to say about the episode. That's not this literal, concrete, or a tactile either emotion or event or whatever. It's these little moments. But all right, let's summarize the rest of this episode.
Sure. So the gang follows the flute sound. They discover there's a cassette deck that's making it. They turn around. They're locked now in the basement. The same room that we saw, I think the last episode even, where a woman was attacked by some crazy manifestation of that kid's dream, whatever, that crazy monster with the funky hand. So they're in the basement of the school. Meanwhile, Buffy and Cordelia are talking. This is where Buffy has that line. Buffy talks about being popular in LA. So the gang gets trapped. The gas is on. They're all going to be killed by the gas. Buffy is attacked and knocked out of the ceiling area how does she get here? She's up in the ceiling now. She's looking around. She gets attacked and knocked. She falls out of the ceiling area. She falls on the ground. And then this is the scariest moment, a floating needle. Like it's going to hypodermic needle is going to inject something in her neck. And it does, a flying syringe. Now we're at the Bronze. Buffy and Cordelia are tied up. It's this amazing set and scene. With this like 80s horror vibe. It's freaking rad. Cordelia can't feel her face. She's freaking out. Then we cut to Giles burns his hand trying to like slow the gas somehow. This whole scene is young boy boner scene though, like of Cordelia and Buffy tied up. It's like, it's kind of, they're kind of sexily tied up in the scene because they're all well-dressed like there's an event that's about to happen. Anyway, I respond to that scene. And then...
Did you respond with a handwritten letter? I mean, what are you saying you responded to that scene?
Look, I'm just saying there was a response to that scene when I watched it, and I was very excited that that scene happened. I was surprised with how, like, well it was put together. It was like...
You want to say, I go on record not being surprised because you look like Xander Harris. End scene.
So here Marcy confesses everything that's been going on. She wants to destroy Cordelia. And she wants to give her a new face so people will remember her forever. As someone that's been forgotten forever, she wants some people to remember her forever, especially with her new face that she's going to make for her. So this is like, it's probably the best fight scene I've seen so far in a Buffy kind of show, even though it's completely with an invisible character, but like, it's really great. And this great moment happens. Cause we're cutting back and forth still, but this great moment happens though, where Buffy has to listen. She literally has to listen. So she's able to escape from her ropes or whatever for the invisible girl. And she's able to find her and punch her. And it just takes one or two Buffy punches and you're done. But it's still like a great little moment that calls back, you know, Giles saying that she's going to have to learn how to listen.
Finish up. I'll talk.
Angel shows up, saves the day. The FBI shows up. Torlas and Minetti. We'll take it from here. Don't worry about it. They take the invisible girl away. And then Cordelia says thank you to everybody. She shows up, says thank you to the gang, but it's in a Cordelia way, so she doesn't really mean it. And then the invisible girl is taken to an assassin school where apparently they're turned into assassins by reading Beatles lyrics. Anyway, that's the end of the episode.
I would say Cordelia comes to apologize and means it, but then still has to maintain the old order, which was that the popular, and the unpopular, and the unpopular, but is doing her a little bit to bridge that gap. I guess I think what I have to say about the fight scene and the bronze, I think this might be the most...
It's the only fight scene I've seen with stakes.
I think it might actually be the most well-shot fight scene and also maybe just be the best scene from season one up until now where Buffy is like not moving. So that's what's interesting about it. There's not a lot of movement here, but so she has to close her eyes, that they have this wind machine on because her hair is blowing, trying to like simulate, you know, try to show action. Like that's the action, is her hair moving. And she's closed her eyes and then the camera pans and there's this beautiful bokeh. And it doesn't look like the crappy 16mm that we've been seeing so far for so many freaking episodes. So actually cinematically, it's like amazingly well lit, incredibly well lit, looks great now. The 16mm looks fantastic. The bokeh is good. And it's for most of it. The part I like the best is the one where there's no freaking action except for the simulated movement from her hair. So
no, that's a really magical one.
That might be insane.
That little scene where she's listening and it's like it's a slow motion scene of her hair blowing is freaking like for that second is awesome.
It's amazing.
That was a cool
moment.
I was surprised by it.
Oh yeah, and it's a fantastic fan. I mean, I just watched that and was like, oh my god, this is the best shot lit and pan scene so far this season. And then, of course, you know, the last... So, all right, that's it. All right, I'll stop talking.
So, what's going on in this episode? We can talk about the themes in this episode. I just want to briefly mention, though, this feels like, you know, Joss Whedon maybe thinks that this could be an X-Files type show. Really, really confused about the Men in Black here coming to take the Invisible Girl away. But we don't really know how to deal with a high school student that's the bad guy. Like... You know, how do we deal with these characters? We don't kill them. Normally we just kill them. But if they don't die, what happens? And I guess she's such a powerless, sad character that we really identify with, that all the characters end with, we can't kill her off, and so it makes sense to take her away? And then she's taken away to the weirdest place possible. So, like, I kind of... Man, I don't want to jump into predictions yet, but at the same time, like, this sets up an insane like next episode if it's incorporated at all. And I can't imagine it is. It feels so different from everything else, but like, I want to see this invisible assassin character. I want to see this played out. Ah, like it has to happen. Yeah.
I have some questions about that. Like, there's all those like invisible kids in this classroom. So it's not the Charles Xavier school, you know, they don't all have different powers. They're all invisible, right? And the reason that she's invisible is because of this weird mixture of quantum mechanics and Hellmouth. So are all those kids from Sunnydale High School?
No, I mean, I didn't want to bring this up because it's this huge, like, huge kind of failing of the episode, which I thought you would totally criticize because it's the end of the episode where nothing is different and it makes no sense. The only thing I would tell you is that this ending is something that it's like part of the world in the sense that you get accustomed to strange things happening in the Buffyverse and there being outside forces that eventually take advantage of people with strange abilities so in a sense, without violating the timeline, the ending of this episode makes sense, but only in a sad way. Like, I would say, to me, I was disappointed by the ending where they just took her off. I would definitely have a different ending this episode if I could, because it's like the throwaway endings from the first six episodes or whatever. The first six episodes of the season.
This feels different though than the throwaway episodes, because they did this whole Men in Black thing where they take her off. Like,
but it's a throwaway.
There's literally an X-Files episode like this that involves clone girls. And it's like they're made at a special clone institution and they're made to do dumb, crazy shit. And it's like, oh, this is either an homage to that or it's like this has got to be called back. I mean, there's so many strange characters. There's a girl who's trapped in a trophy. You know, there's so many.
Yeah. There's callbacks everywhere, I guess. But I don't want to get into the end of the scene.
I feel like there's so much potential for season two just based on the amount of callbacks to all these things.
Yes, I agree.
And I hope that they call back to them and deal with these stories, because that'll be like, I think it has a chance to take these stories to a new place with these things.
Yeah. Did you notice that Marcy knows that Buffy's the Slayer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's been listening. She's been spying. Right.
So she's been listening. She's been spying. So she gets it on some level. We don't know how much she knows, but she teases Buffy. Like, what are you going to slay me? So she must know something, right?
She doesn't know. Yeah, she doesn't. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of physical violence at this. There's been a lot of physical violence at the school. She should know how strong Buffy is, but she just doesn't.
Yeah, but does that then imply that, like, this government agency also knows? Is she going to tell them? So, like, does that imply the government, therefore, knows about the Slayer as a thing?
Do you want me to violate the timeline?
I don't. It sounds like
they will eventually know.
Yeah,
the Slayer in situation, and that again a prediction, but it sounds like the government eventually has to get involved in this demon nonsense in some way, because Buffy is potentially a really powerful ally for the U.S. government, or needs to be allied with it, and which is insane. I don't want that to happen. I feel like that violates the interesting story world of Buffy to do that, but I think the show is like, maybe we'll do that. Buffy will work for the U.S. government, and this will become Alias. Like, I don't freaking know. It's like, well, maybe this could happen. So maybe there's a version of this where Buffy is a part of this assassin squad. She's leading an army of invisible assassins to go fight various terrorist organizations and cultists. I don't know.
New podcast.
Don't violate the timeline.
Making a fan fiction about Buffy.
Oh God, no kidding. So I mean, yeah, I guess I was. This is me. This is me being the contrarian and saying to you two, I do not like the last minute of this episode. I dislike it furiously with so much venom. I am envenomated by this the last minute of this episode, but I love everything that came before it. So again, it's me. You know, I'm the Buffy defender.
The FBI shit is so unnecessary. That's why. It doesn't fucking need to happen. Why the fuck did they do that?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much timeline stuff.
They have to make the visible girl visible. Is that why, or they have to kill her, right? And they can't kill someone that's such like a pathetic character. Like, I don't understand why they invented that. That was totally after the fact. They came up with like, and then Joss Whedon's like, we'll get rid of the FBI. They'll take you away and be like X-Files. Like,
Travis, I have Dr. Travis, I have some medical questions for you. Two of them.
Oh my God.
So my first question is, in what year did doctors cease to carry little black bags? Because I think that Marcy has found like a doctor's bag from like the 1940s.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny that you say it. Yeah, the traditional doctor's bag, you don't carry anymore because, right, it's got to be just not sanitary and you don't have any stuff in it because it's all like controlled substances or, yeah, you're right. Yeah. So yeah, we don't have that, but it's a great gag. Like, it's a great visual gag. Although of course, if you watch the British TV show, Doc Martin, that's technically filmed in the 1990s or 2000s, probably 1990s. Well, it's actually set in the 1990s, I think. Doc Martin, he has a little doctor's bag, but he's British.
Okay.
So anyway, so it's just like a visual gag. You're right.
Second question: is it actually possible? And I'm really asking here: is it actually possible to numb someone's face such that they are numb, but they still can still talk?
They wouldn't talk very well the way that she talks. Yeah. Not. Also, you'd have to be like a plastic surgeon to really know. To really numb someone's face like that well, and she'd have little, she would have these little drops of dried blood wherever the needle went in, anyways, along her face. So, yeah, I mean, you can numb parts of the face, but
probably what happened is that Marcy like numbed like her upper lip a little bit, and then had she actually cut into her, she would have totally felt it.
Yeah. So how does Marcy know about all this medical shit? Because she also puts a syringe in Buffy, and like. No sense for her to go on the separate dentist doctor track.
My hunch is she just broke into the school.
She's educating herself in the school. Like, this is pre YouTube. I don't buy it.
She broke into the nurse's office.
I guess she's invisible. It could go to a doctor's office and watch procedures in place.
Yeah, she could do whatever. Yeah. I think that's sort of the weakness of the episode, those details. I think one of the great things is Angel makes a surprising rescue. He's very useful.
Yeah, Angel does something.
And then Giles lies about it.
Oh, everybody lies about Giles. Which is weird.
That's for Buffy's sake. They don't want to bring him up.
Vampires don't breathe.
So helpful of them to lie to her. I was disappointed with their choice to lie. Let's talk about themes in this episode. So we talked about the theme here of isolation a bit going through this. But about alienation, isolation. Have we covered everything, really? Is there something else to get into from that?
I'm not sure how much I want to bring this up. This is going to come up more in Buffy, but I think... never mind. There's nothing there. Never mind.
All right, cool. Nothing there. Cool. Let's keep it where it is. Any other themes in this episode? About invisibility?
I do want to say I disagree with you that giving the metaphor substance is a boring thing to do. I think that is really at the heart of what makes Buffy fun, is just taking the metaphor literally. It's less making it a deeper or stronger kind of fiction and more it's just a kind of fun joke. It's taking the metaphor literally is something I really enjoy in Buffy.
So I disagree because when you take the metaphor literally, you don't have a good ending built in to this story, right? When you take the metaphor literally, then you literally have to take the girl away to an invisible school of assassins. Like, they wouldn't have to do that if they kept it as a metaphor, because they wouldn't be talking about it in those same terms. Like, the reveal of the story could be about a sad girl that's alienated and isolated, and that could be enough. And then she could say, like, oh, I'm going to be alienated, I'm going to be invisible, but I'm going to do good things now, or something else at the end. But, like, it doesn't make sense that they have to go to the assassin school. It never makes sense in any version of the story, so that's wrong. I'm sorry I said that. But, like, you can make the climax about the character, and it's not. Because you've just revealed everything that's going on in that character, and now she's a monster.
Well, the interesting part about going the metaphor literally, like, so again, that's a very trademark hallmark.
It's a monster thing, right?
Like, the interesting thing is that you get to a very different place when you take the metaphor literally. Like, your stories are different. Your ending is different. I disagree with the current ending, but I'm saying they could have gotten to a better ending still by taking the metaphor literally that they have. I just simply disagree with how it ended. But by doing that, that's what makes a story different, because you write different things when it's literal, and people say and do different things when it's literal rather than just metaphorical. So I think that's I agree. That's the strength. That's the hallmark of Buffy for many, many, many episodes. So,
John, I'm changed my mind. I think I agree with you.
That was quick.
You just get to a different.
Oh. No, I'm thinking now about all the urban fantasy stuff I've seen, which is like modern fantasy. It doesn't work without people literally being characters. Without it's like, oh, she's invisible because she was so in there for a long time, she became invisible. That's just something that happens. And like a lot of modern fantasy is built on the existence of characters, and then these explanations that are kind of these metaphorical explanations, but it's like, oh, and then that's true, and that's what happens. And like, that is more interesting if you can build from that, but they don't build from it in an interesting way in this episode. Like, oh, cool, that's metaphorically true. She should be an assassin. Like, you know,
it's less of an ending, more of a punchline almost. Like, and I agree with that, but I, in a way, to me, I'm not saying it's great drama or anything, but I feel
because
like...
Because the great drama would be Buffy becomes invisible in this episode, and it doesn't happen, because that is something that happens if someone's alien isolated, and they don't do that, right. And I don't know why.
I don't know. I think it's better that she doesn't, because I think I do... One of the things I related to in this episode a lot was Buffy realizing that, you know, her suffering wasn't comparable to this other person. And it's like, oh, I may have some understanding of what she's going through, but not completely. There was something that I really dug about that, you know, that Willow and Xander, you know, again, they're like, well, we're not the cool kids, but at least we have friends, you know? And there was something to that where it's like that moment of realizing, yeah, I may have problems, but I'm not that guy. Was something I related quite a bit.
So how would you handle a story with invisibility, John?
I don't know. I don't write for television.
But you could.
Sorry, that's a very cop-out answer. I don't know.
Tighten it up.
I don't know. I don't think I necessarily need the ending to be a part of the meditation. I don't require of this episode that the ending be part of the meditation on what it means to feel outcast. I think that the episode does that fine in the middle, and I'm okay that the ending is basically just a joke. I'm kind of fine with that.
I disagree. I disagree strongly. And the fact that you cannot see me through a video chat only makes my point stronger. For the people listening, there's a video chat, and I'm invisible by accident, pure chance. I'll tell you what. If I had to go back and change this, what would I want? Where would I have the ending stop and a different ending begin? I'm happy with almost everything up until where Buffy hits Marcy and she's in this red curtain. Okay. I'll tell you this. You can call me insane or strange or different or invisible, but I actually don't need to know literally how that is wrapped up. Like, is Marcy literally going to be, you know, put like, you know, tied up in a carpet or a curtain for the rest of her natural or unnatural life? I don't literally need to see that. We figured out the real issue here. Real issue is people being mean and people not being able to fit in and not having friends. And that's the huge struggle for me. That was what's interesting. You want to have people, you want to have friends that really tell you things that you can relate with. And so to me, the ending that I would go on from that is I want to see Giles and Xander and Willow lie to Buffy and lie and lie and lie to her. And that would be this bitter, friendless ending that emotionally the episode deserves.
Hmm. Wow.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, the lie is a big deal. You're right. And like they play it off like it's just
not a big deal. But emotionally, that's where you're at. You're not ready for some like, oh, wacky, yeah, she's going to be an assassin. No, it's like you're ready for something else. You're fearful that there's this more horrible, because people can be horrible in so many different ways. And here, these are her friends, but are they really her friends? Is Buffy really alone? That's the end of the episode. And that's what you need to play on, because if these people aren't really her friends, if they're not really telling her the truth, then Buffy is just like Cordelia in so many ways, and she is alone.
Oh. Yeah, that's a powerful ending, a much more powerful ending than they chose to go with.
True. Should we talk about the degree to which this episode is basically a watered down version of Carrie?
Oh.
Like, it's something that just occurred to me. The prom scene, the revenge element. It's a lot of Carrie in this.
I actually have not seen Carrie.
I haven't seen it recently enough to really go into it. We should probably cut this out if I can't remember the movie that well.
I cannot comment, but we need
only to Dennis Carrie. Was here. I'm sure Dennis remembers Carrie.
I'm sure Dennis would be like, oh, there's like 5 similarities or 10 similarities.
Yeah.
To point of fact, I think if I remember correctly, the May Queen is different from prom because there is a prom episode later in Buffy. So I feel the May Queen is different. Maybe it's just for underclassmen.
Dumb question. We know that the school has facilities. It's a big school. They have an auditorium, et cetera. They have a
cafeteria. They have an insanely large locker room.
Why are they holding events at the Bronze?
It's the Bronze. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. Even I'm not sure. So I guess I'll do my little thing. So Mike and John, I always yell at Mike, John, I'm sorry, because I know you love Buffy anyways.
And oh, Mike, I do. I love it.
Mike kind of loves Buffy too. Yeah. So and Mike's the virgin. Mike's definitely the virgin of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike, season 1, episode 11. Can you tell me, you know, your opinion, theme, you know, how does this episode rate within the episodes you've seen? You know, what did you not expect based upon starting this from the beginning? You know, give me some feedback, you know, and thematically and the pacing. Tell me how the pacing of this episode is. That's the thing I'm always harping on. You haven't heard it from anyone in a couple of podcasts, but I'm the insane person always talking about pacing to episodes. How well was this episode paced, Mike and John?
So I already thought we had a Cordelia episode, so I was a little surprised that it was another Cordelia episode. I thought that the witch episode was a Cordelia episode-ish. No, John, you're making a face.
I mean, I don't think it was mainly about Cordelia. I think in that episode, Cordelia was still playing the role of, if not the villain, you know, she's the bitch. And I was so happy in this episode that we finally have some dimension to Cordelia. It's the first time we get anything. And they did it, I think they did it well, such that like they didn't stop constantly jabbing at her and having her constantly say things that reveal her to be awful, right?
Mm-hmm.
They also once in a while gave her something to say that was like, allowed her to be a person. I was so finally happy to see that. Because she's just been like this repository for like, basically like, bitch. She's been this like just this trash can of like everything we don't like about women, and it's also gendered, and we're all just sort of like, she's, you know, she's a slut, she's self-obsessed, she's, you know, she's mean, she's catty, she's all these things we just keep throwing at her. Finally we gave her something else to do, so I was really happy to see that get softened at least a little.
And how about the pacing?
Oh, I thought the pacing was really good in this episode, probably the strongest pacing in an episode, really. Like, I think they did a good job of, like, I know I was complaining about it, but they do a good job of, like, jumping quickly to the answer of who the villain is and then delving into the character, you know, and making it, I feel like it's a very interesting episode. But it's not interesting enough, like, oh, cool, everyone feels isolated, but we don't really have, and then Buffy is ultimately isolated because her friends lie to her. And they don't go into that, you're totally right, like, that would have been the better ending. Instead, it's about a monster. It's about the invisible monster.
Mm.
It could have had a lot more of an exciting conclusion where it's like, you know, Cordelia ultimately has to become the same isolated, popular person she was. She briefly connected with Buffy and the gang, and now back to being herself, right? Or whatever that is, you know. And then Buffy, you know, thinks that she has friends and she doesn't. And like that would be a really cool ending for this, but they don't do that. But the pacing is fantastic. Overall, I think it's one of the strongest episodes in season 1, definitely. I feel like it has the most, the villain is the most believable.
Yeah.
And Clea Duvall's great. I really like her a lot.
We need to do a special podcast on her because apparently she just directed and released a movie.
Yeah, she did. I saw that.
Yeah, and it's actually, I think it was released by Dusty's old bosses at Samuel Goldwyn. So it's like it literally just got on streaming like 2 months ago. So we definitely should do a shout out podcast just on that for her because she stars in it, directs it, and I think wrote it.
Well, maybe after we finish this season, we can jump into all of the references that we want to. That'd be fine with me.
What's the movie she was in? The Faculty.
The Faculty. It's another high school movie.
Oh, yeah. So good.
That's why she's actually in Argo. So I've actually seen her. So she's actually...
But I'm a cheerleader.
Yeah, right. We should definitely watch The Faculty because that's also... Anyways, how do I think about this episode? How do I rate it? John, I didn't hear you rate it within the canon of... Within the
I like it quite a bit.
Season one.
I think it's very Monster of the Week. I think where it shines, bracketing is sort of aside all the really interesting stuff that you just said about Buffy being alone because he's being lied to, or something I haven't really considered.
Thank you.
But leaving that to the side, I think it's basically a Monster of the Week episode, but it's a good one. And it's not as good as iRobot Eugene, but it's maybe the second best that we've had so far.
You think iRobot Eugene is a stronger show?
I love iRobot Eugene. And you're not
it's insane. iRobot Eugene is great. So where did I rank this? I'm just looking at all the episodes.
It's anachronistic. That's why you like it.
So? Is that a problem for you?
No, it's just...
So I didn't get a chance to comment on the puppet show and Nightmares, and I'm still waiting to comment on that later. Out of mind, out of sight. So what do I think is great about this? I think it is one of the strongest episodes of the first season for sure. I think it's that way because for a couple of things. I think the story, the metaphor is quite strong. I'm not crazy actually about the monster, and I have my reservations. I really usually have reservations about monsters in the show and how they're resolved. I think here the pacing is absolutely fantastic here. I think what's also really fun about this episode is that most of it takes place in the high school. So there is this great high school horror vibe. And then, of course, you know, you get to see the character development of Cordelia, which is fun. I mean, I think overall, it's an overall package. I don't think any single event in this episode is actually all that amazing, but the overall package is really compelling. And I think finally, maybe it is like these stolen moments where Buffy and Cordelia are trying to connect or you're just trying to have like see what like normalcy is. I think without it being like this normal, you know, all the weird normal stuff that like is delved into before with Xander being some sex hound and all sort of stuff. I mean, I think that's great is that it wasn't, so that part wasn't in it. I think maybe just like seeing like these stolen moments of normalcy is what made it memorable. And I think maybe just the overall... I think that for me is what really did it. But it's not like I'm crazy about the Monster of the Week or the ending of this episode. I think it's really just kind of a few stolen scenes that I think are just really standout scenes and pretty good. And I think everyone hits their lines. I think all the actors hit their lines great in this episode, except, of course, my complaints earlier in the episode where everyone was sort of laughing with their lines. But I definitely rank it up there. I've had to say top four episodes of the first season for sure. I don't really have a lot of great reasons for that other than at the end of it, it feels extremely satisfying. I don't have a lot of like very concrete arguments.
The conclusion is so strong. Like that finale with Cordelia and Buffy is so strong.
It's incredibly strong. Yeah.
Compared to all the other like kind of climax sequences, like the climactic and fight sequences, it's like the best. It's probably the best one in season one easily.
And that may be what it is. I'm just sort of riding that high.
The high. No, totally. It's a wonderful scene. It's a rad scene.
Yeah.
It belongs in like an 80s horror film.
Great. The set of that is great. And actually, you know what? Here's the deal. I know why. It's the best lit episode we've seen so far. There are like no scenes at night and everything is indoors and lit well or outside and lit well. Boom. The only indoor scene is at the Bronze and it's lit extremely well.
I think also because like Cordelia is really a victim. I mean, we kind of empathize with her even though she's a kind of a bitch. Like you really feel for her and what's at stake versus... I think even the scene when Xander is like in a cage and the, you know, his teacher is going to get him. It's kind of like you care about Xander a little bit, but not really that much. Like, they could have killed him then. You're like, well, makes sense. I mean, he's kind of a stupid horn dog.
His
like,
best friend was Jesse. Rest in peace.
Yeah, no, he's an idiot, you know? Like, I don't empathize with him as much as I do with Cordelia, where she he ignored someone was shitty, and that happens in high school, and I'm like, I feel for that character.
You could have been Cordelia.
I probably was Cordelia, you know, to somebody.
Yeah. I think that's meant. I think that's
maybe that's why it's very relatable. Maybe that's why this episode is so good, because I think everyone in existence could have been the bad character in this episode, where they just simply ignored someone, and not even out of spite, just ignore it. Just they weren't in their lives. There wasn't room.
Well, and that's an interesting something different than maybe what it is normally portrayed about high school. Where if you look at John Hughes movies, like you look at Breakfast Club, and the whole point of Breakfast Club is that everybody occupies these really rigid roles, right? And a big part of the message of this episode is that those roles are actually really relative. That I thought of myself as, you know, in this way, but I was probably Cordelia to somebody, right? And that, you know, Xander and Willow feel like they're basically good people, but they also participated in ignoring her, and you know, they were cruel to somebody. I think that's really, really kind of cool and really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what the next strongest episode is for me. I mean, I don't think Angel is a great episode necessarily, but I think the story with Angel and his ex, can't think of her name just now.
Darla.
It's so messed up. It's so dark and weird, and then just cut so short. I feel like that makes that one pretty strong. Like,
it is so messed up.
I feel like it was an interesting, weird story. How it gets resolved doesn't really get resolved, but like that's kind of, I think that's, those are the two strong.
I'm with John. I wrote about you, Jane.
What?
I also love nightmares, but that's because it's the hospital. But anyways, I'll comment on that later, but I want to, but yeah, anyways. All right. That's kind of everything I wanted to say about this episode. What did you guys have? Anything else you wanted to bring up? Mm-hmm. Next episode is the last episode of season one, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
I never thought we'd get here.
When Mike would have turned off the episode, should we do those?
Oh, yeah, do that.
Yeah.
Well, I already said my predictions, really, is like the Invisible Assassins are going to be characters later. Buffy is going to get involved with the U.S. government. And it's not because I want those things to happen. It's because the show is telling me this will happen. And that the FBI, which is like, she's like, hey, where are you taking her? It's like, need to know. Sorry. Thank you so much for your time, or whatever they say, right? Like, clearly they wouldn't have caught this Invisible Girl without Buffy. Or they have some plan because they apparently have caught six more, or who knows how many more. But Buffy was a convenient way for them to capture them. Okay. But why don't they recruit Buffy immediately? Yeah, let's dismiss her out of hand and get another Invisible Assassin in our crew.
So when would you have turned off the episode, Mike?
This was a fun episode. I don't think I would have shut this one off. This was really fun throughout. Like,
wow.
I could watch this one. If this was the first episode you had me watch, I think I would be very interested in this show.
The writing's
really funny. I felt like I was laughing. I feel like Kudori is such a fun character. Like, and she's given a little bit of mention, but mostly she's really funny. And I like the way she makes fun of the Scooby gang in a way that, like, I don't see the Scooby gang and no one else does either.
Oh, I forgot to mention this. It's a subtle thing, but when Buffy is chasing the Marcy for the first time into the band room, the door has a poster on it, or has a piece of paper on it that says "School Spirit."
Yeah, I totally saw that. That was so true.
Yeah. All right.
I think this. I like it because it feels like a traditional '80s horror film reinvented, with actually a little bit deeper characterization than you might find in that film, because they would have treated the invisibility as a metaphor like Carrie does. Because Carrie is not really that deep. It's like emotionally interesting, and like the rage, Carrie's rage is like fun to feel along with her. But this show doesn't do that. You don't really empathize with the Carrie character. You're empathizing with the people who are victimized. And that's an interesting choice. It's a different enough choice that I think I would have kept watching.
Awesome. John, do you have any last words to talk about for this episode?
Nothing good. I've got some more BS things, some more like crap nitpicks, but nothing of substance.
Yeah. Well, let's not end on nitpicks. Keep those nitpicks.
Yeah, they're not worth bringing up.
Yeah. So I think for me, I think I blabbered on enough. Again, thank you for listening to the podcast. I'm Travis, and sorry I was gone a couple episodes, but it's good to be back defending Buffy to everything.
We miss you, Travis. We need your voice.
I know. My insanity. So thanks for listening to the podcast. Have a great day.
All right.
Thanks. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening. Reach out to us at BuffyVirgin.com in the comments section to talk more about Buffy. Anyway, thanks so much. Have a great week.